Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, a podcast for those who are pathologically interested in history, critical theory, philosophy, aesthetics, or anything that may inform the modern world.
This is the first episode of a two-part discussion with Dan from the Knowledge Fight podcast on Alex Jones and conspiracy culture.
Welcome to Symptomatic Redness. Today we're talking to Dan from the Knowledge Fight podcast, a podcast about Alex Jones and the weird world around Alex Jones. One of the fascinating things about the Knowledge Fight podcast is, Dan, you do a good job of making me feel like Alex Jones is actually relevant to something as opposed to a joke.
Oh, well, that's not my goal, but...
I mean, I wish he was a joke. I mean, that's sort of the thing. So... How did you get started, you know, going through the catalogs and listening to hours and hours and hours and hours of Alex Jones show?
Well, I mean, I've known about Alex for quite a while. Like, I'd watch him in my sort of, I always think it was in college, but it was probably like after college or around, you know, it's that period years back. I was sort of vaguely aware of him and, would use him for entertainment purposes, you know, like sometimes you get high and look at videos on YouTube and like, oh, look at this guy yelling, that sort of thing. And I've always been drawn to conspiracy theories. So like it always entertained me to hear somebody propose the opposite of what everyone else thinks. And so I knew him from that. But then in the sort of lead up to the 2016 election, you know, you'd start to see a little bit more of him being reported on. And I started to see. I just checked in. I'd watch an episode here or there, and I started to notice a trend where he was like way more religious than I remembered him being. Like he was talking about needing Jesus all the time, and I started to notice that he was super into Trump, and it just seemed incongruous to me from the guy that I remembered from when I would watch him yell about conspiracies and stuff. And so I just started to feel like there was something going on, and I really wanted to know what that thing was. It was really an intellectual curiosity more than anything. And then simultaneously at the same time, before that, I'd been doing stand-up for a number of years. And I just felt really kind of done with it. I felt like it wasn't what I wanted to do. It wasn't really scratching whatever itch I had in terms of doing something I felt was meaningful. And so I just started putting more time into trying to sort out what it was about Alex that had changed. I just went from there. You know, just you watch a couple episodes of him and he'll start to give specifics about like where his ideas come from, and the ball starts rolling. You start looking into those things, and before you know it, it's 2 years in and it's become a job, kind of.
One of the things that we talked about off air just before we got on is you were telling me how much research you end up having to do for this. And often it's like little triggers where you'll see Jones using a specific miswording, or he'll quote an article somewhere and misquote it in a very particular way. And then you have to read like two books and 50 Wikipedia articles to figure out exactly not only what it is that he's referring to, but why he's twisting the words and the way he's twisting them or what he's leaving out.
Yeah. It's not great. It's a bad business model for me personally.
Other than worrying about your continued sanity, what do you think you've learned the most about from studying Jones, and what has surprised you the most?
I guess one of the things that I've learned is that when you appeal to emotion and those sorts of things, it's really easy to get people to think you know what you're talking about when you don't. Like, sort of the nature of like misinformation and propaganda, like the thing that I've learned the most isn't very specific, I guess. It's just constantly reinforced by going through Alex's career, like no matter what time period we're in, whether it's, you know, we found some videos of his from the like mid late 90s. And then we focused heavily on like 2009, 2015, 2012 in the present day. And consistently, whenever he brings up a primary source of any kind, if you go find that primary source, it doesn't say what he says it says. And generally, when he talks about news, he's only referring to headlines. He hasn't read the article that the headline is attached to. And so I guess the lesson that I've learned the most is definitely that, like, people who are doing this misinformation often aren't really doing a lot of work. And so they're taking a lot of shortcuts, and people fall for them very easily.
So one of the things that I've noticed about from listening to your show about Jones is he, to put it somewhat mildly, collects grifters.
Oh, yeah.
And it's sometimes hard to figure out exactly what the angle is. Do you think that that's deliberate on his part? And do you think it's political, or is it a business model, or both?
I think it's a business model. I don't know if there is an agenda to the grift. I think for a lot of folks, the grift is the grift. Like, it is a means and an end unto itself. I don't know, because it's really weird. They're like over spans of time, the sort of character of the grifters change. You know, like before, there was a lot of gold bug types who were hanging around. A lot of people who were their bread and butter was, you know, yelling about economic collapse and then selling gold. You know, that was a large part of the business model. And then as things evolved and Alex started selling more supplements, you started to hear more people who would come in and talk about the dangers of the stuff in the water. It, even if that was a piece of Alex's world before, it was amplified a bit more. And, you know, then they're selling their supplements and stuff. And then now it's sort of transitioned into a lot of grifters who are on sort of, you know, free speech grifts and things like that. I don't know. It doesn't seem like it's ideological throughout. It feels very much like people just like the hustle is the hustle, no matter what form it takes. And Alex is there to facilitate it because he probably wants to get a cut of it in some way.
So one of my big questions in regards to someone like Alex Jones, and maybe why we would consider Alex Jones of any importance, because there are days when I wake up and I think Alex Jones is just a spectacle.
Me too.
We were talking about this. Sometimes I'm not alone, but I do feel like you learn something about the way this world works. One of the fascinating things about, like, say, the dissident right, as opposed to, like, your mainstream Republican, is in this era of Trump, there's a whole lot of forces that wouldn't have signed on to the GOP or even Trump's agenda, frankly, that have all of a sudden. I mean, you pointed out on your show that it's actually almost out of character that Webster Tarpley was morally consistent.
Yeah, that was a huge shock to me.
So what do you think we can learn about these kind of fringe areas of the right from following sort of its, at one time, most popular media figure? And I don't know how, I mean, it's also harder to say that Jones is super distinct from, I don't know, Fox News at this point, but mm-hmm. until recently that they were. So
yeah, definitely. They were at loggerheads with each other until fairly recently. Alex would constantly scream about how terrible Fox was and how they offered him a huge contract and he would never take it. And now they're very similar in terms of the narratives and talking points, especially if you look at like a Hannity or a Tucker. And Alex has changed his tune. He now plays clips of Tucker and Hannity on his show and talks about how great they are. So there's definitely some sort of a synthesis between the. I don't know what you can learn from it, though. I'm not entirely sure, because I'm kind of hesitant to make any kind of blanket declarations mm-hmm. from the things I've learned about the shifting of the right over towards the more paranoid conspiratorial fringe right. Because I think that there's a decent chance that some people who have gone along with that shift didn't know it was happening. So I don't know how much of it is like necessarily a conscious shift that some folks have gone in on the right. I think there's a decent chance that some of it is like frogs in a pot of water. Like the mainstream has become so much more in the media sphere, especially, has become so much more close to Alex Jones, but it may have happened fairly incrementally and without people noticing. I'm not entirely sure. It's probably an unsatisfying answer, but I'm not entirely sure if I my journeys have taught me too much about that specifically.
Well, I admire the the urge not to overgeneralize, so I won't push it too hard on that.
I have to fight that instinct in myself all the time. But trust me, I wish that I could allow myself to just rant like Alex does.
So one of the fascinating things that, and the reason why I initially contacted you is I was listening to your 2008-2009 investigation where you were trying to figure out the moment where, you know, Soros became the great Satan for Alex. Because Alex Jones has this tendency to retrodirect his current, you know, conspiracy or our political philosophy way back into the past. And while there are some things that are consistent, and we can get to that later, like Soros actually isn't.
Not at all. It's not even close to consistent throughout his
But what I noticed is in the time period that you were looking at for the Soros stuff was in the Bush to Obama transition. And at that time, it seemed like Alex was much more interested in like fringe left versus fringe left and fringe right alliances, like having KRS-One on and stuff like that. So you said that around 2009, there was a second documentary about Obama that you hadn't covered yet. And you wonder if that's where the like, fuck all Democrats and all leftists and they're all secretly communist.
I think that there's I think there's something to that being a major piece of Alex's transition. And then I also think that there's the disillusionment that came with the end of Ron Paul being a legitimate fantasy for people on the right and the libertarians to have. Because I think that for a very long time, Alex held out this belief that, you know, it was only a matter of time before Ron Paul broke through and everyone would see the truth and they'd get rid of the Federal Reserve and everyone would be happy. And, you know, in the 2008 election, there was much cause for thinking that, oh, Ron Paul got screwed, but they'll get him next time. And then that went away in the 2012 election. So I think somewhere in that span was when Alex lost his horse in the race, and it sort of freed him up to go full against the left.
Right. It does seem like there. Do you remember this phrase from the mid-aughts, particularly the late Bush years, not even more than the Obama years, the libertarians?
No, but it sounds like a familiar idea.
Yeah, you know, the idea that there'd be a libertarian liberal/leftist allegiance against the basically neoconservative foreign policy that was kind of in the water for a while. Mm-hmm. And it seems to have completely dissipated by the middle of the Obama years from both sides. I mean,
right.
Scott Horton from anti-war radio was the only libertarian who would consistently talk to socialists and stuff after a while. So it was interesting. That said, I think the Ron Paul analogy is interesting because Ron Paul is one of those figures that, and I don't want to disparage the man.
I will.
Although my audience would have no problem with disparaging him, but I try to be meticulously fair when talking about right-wingers.
Sure.
Ron Paul's own history is much more sketchy than people realize. And I remember in 2008 on LiveJournal, of all things, you know, telling people like, you know, look at what he's actually supported before you see him as, you know, anti-war plus gold candidate.
Yeah. Like, look at his newsletters that he claims he didn't write. Look at his congressional record. See if he's actually even pushed for the things that you say that he's pushed for. Like, has he actually ever sponsored, drug legalization laws? Like, everyone says that, you know, people on the left say Ron Paul's great because he's against war and he's for drug legalization. Those sorts of ideas. Like, does his record match that? I don't know.
Yeah,
I kind of know.
Yeah, I was going to say you do actually know, but, but yeah, I mean, I think you have to deal with certain key figures in that I think the word for that was the paleo libertarian movement. Mm-hmm. And even before the, you know, the Trump era, and you had a lot of these libertarians become explicit nationalists, there was a lot of that in that world. I mean, Lou Rockwell, who Ron Paul was close to, published Gary North. Mentioned this to you off air. And do you know who he is?
Not specifically.
So he was the heir to Rush Dooney. He was a Dominionist.
Okay.
And actually, it was another libertarian magazine that outed this. But basically, he supported libertarian economics, and also, if you got the government out of the way, then it wouldn't be that hard to have a theocracy in a small town where you could stone all the gay people.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, that's underneath a lot of the ideas we come across.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I remember in the early aughts kind of being taken into this and then finding this figure, and then I started going down a very dark rabbit hole. I'm like, this person defends Nazis and not like just on a principle free speech thing. And oh God.
Oh no.
Yeah. You know, why am I reading Evola? You know, that sort of thing.
Right.
It is hard to me to tell. And this, even after listening to your show, how much Alex is aware of this.
Of which aspect?
The more sketchy elements. For example, like the way he handles anti-Semitism, like he does, he speaks in a lot of anti-Semitic dog whistles. He does,
for sure.
But he also is really quick to tamp down on actual anti-Semites calling into a show.
Uh-huh.
Or at least he was.
Overt ones, yeah, for sure. He argues with them.
Right. Not. Covert ones, he seems to not care. But do you think he knows that the covert anti-Semites and racists are what they are?
I feel like it would be really hard for him not to be aware of that. It's a tough question because it kind of comes to intent and like trying to imagine what goes on in his head, and that's kind of difficult. But I from everything I can tell, he's aware of the nature of the things he's saying. It feels that way. But I think that he knows that it's a potent tool. It's a potent rhetorical tool for him to use.
Well, I ask because you pinned down on a point with the Sandy Hook stuff. I was listening to you and you guys pointed out where it sounded like he made a decision, for example, to go down the conspiracy route, mainly actually for another political point. And you almost hear it in his voice, like he sound like it's one of the few times where he sounds legitimately pained about something, not just like he's drunk crying. But
Those moments of like the times where it feels like there's an actual thought process or like emotion are always particularly tough for me. Because you don't like to imagine a monster actually struggles with something, but unfortunately, I think the real world does work that way, and sometimes. A bad dude can have a crisis about doing a bad thing.
Well, it's one of the open questions about Alex Jones that I've always sort of, not to exculpate him for anything he's done, particularly in regards to Sandy Hook. He's clearly lied about his own position. Like,
oh yeah, 1,000%.
You have caught him on it. I've listened to you. So I was like, oh no, he said that. like early on too, actually.
Yeah, days from the shooting.
Yeah, it only took you three or four episodes to find the first, like, flirting with false flag.
Oh, so, I think it was the day of he was flirting with false flag, but the actor's idea, the shooting was on December 14th, and by the 19th, he's already speculating that people were actors. So, yeah, it was much quicker than even I thought.
So I always kind of wonder if that process goes on in other questions, like when... Like, how much does he know? Because I'll also say one of the most interesting things to me is how drunk he gets.
Oh, yeah.
And some of the crazy stuff is maintained when he's drunk.
Yeah, that kind of gives you the feeling of sincerity. The fact that he'll be that fucked up on air and there's still, like, the idea, or at least sort of narrative consistency. Mm-hmm. He doesn't slip up when he's drunk, except for to say, stupid things. He says things that are very dumb. But he doesn't like say, hey guy, what I've been really talking about this whole time is Jews or something like that. He never has those breaks despite his intoxication.
Right. And so that I find fascinating because it indicates that even if he's lying, he's actually convincing himself, which in some ways is even more horrifying, right? If that's the case, but
it's troubling for sure.
But it's fascinating to me how I feel about him as opposed to how I feel about Paul Joseph Watson or the Hellfire Ranger, or some of these other figures that he invites on. Because I'm almost certain, for example, that the Hellfire Rangers, people don't know who he is. He's a national news guy. If Alex has a body count, and you've made a you've made a fairly convincing argument that he might. The Health Ranger's body count's actually higher. I mean,
oh, in terms of like the medical misinformation that he's put out into the world, like the damaging effects.
Yeah,
of it?
I don't think he's had anyone shot, but like.
No, I totally agree with that. I think the ideas he has espoused have been probably far more wide-rangingly damaging. But all those views that he espouses, Alex allows him to come on his show and disseminate the same ideas.
True.
So they're kind of holding hands with each other in terms of that death toll, if you want to, go that route.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that it's useful to go that route, but it is something I think about. Like, how culpable do we hold these people? And Alex, it seems like, is getting the bulk of the culpability factor. One of the things that I have thought about, for example, I have never known how to feel about Twitter or YouTube pulling Alex off because the people they haven't pulled off.
Sure. That's a tough argument I think that it's easy to get around it by just, still critiquing Twitter and being like, well, these horrible people are still on, but you kicked Alex off. It's not an argument to keep Alex on. It's an argument for them to kick more people off.
Right. Yeah, you either need to kick more people off or I don't know. I mean, like the free speech conundrum is to me is not actually easy to deal with. One of the horrifying things that I've discovered about the way free speech has been used is it's been weaponized since the 60s by the far right. I mean, the first person that I know that really screamed that was George Lincoln Rockwell.
Sure. Yeah, there's a tradition in that sphere like you said, weaponize the idea of free speech.
Yeah, I mean, and that's in America, and in Europe it goes back even further.
Sure.
But at the same time, I don't think private platforms should have to. It actually is completely inconsistent for Jones to demand them either. Like, it seems laughable to me that these guys even pretend to hold any libertarian principles anymore. But
the only way they can really make the argument is to make it that sort of faulty. This is a. It's like the phone company. Twitter is like it's a utility like the phone company. That's their way to get around the libertarian inconsistency. The idea of like if the telephone company doesn't allow you to have a phone line in your house, then you aren't able to engage in a basic piece of human life. And I think that that argument could work if, like, let's say the internet itself kicked Alex off, but Twitter kicking him off is it's hard to make that argument. But like I said, that's just how they try to hold on to the appearance of their principles while being like, I need to force you to let me on.
Right. I mean, although at the same time, like, it's not like Paul Joseph Watson can't still get Alex Jones clips onto Facebook.
Or Alex can't just make dummy accounts like he has pretty regularly. Like, you can still find his show on YouTube very easily. Like, you can still find plenty of InfoWars adjacent accounts putting out the same stuff, maybe to a diminished number of followers, but the intent of those bans certainly hasn't been achieved.
So, it's hard for me to feel like bad for Alex Jones in this regard. I know there are some people who thought that maybe pushing him underground, he'd only go stronger. Because, I mean, he did grow for, what, 20, well, not 20, for about 10 to 15 years before our social media.
Mm-hmm.
At the same token, this does seem to have really put a hankering on his business model.
It seems that way. It would be tough to tell without, like, his internal documents and stuff like that, but it feels like he's... the way I always have sort of looked at it is my understanding of his relationship with the audience has always been that he expects a certain amount of people to be attracted to his messages, and then most of them will disappear. They'll either become jaded with his message, figure out that he's full of shit, or like become so sort of numb to it that they'll go to harder far-right stuff and sort of leave him behind. He has that, and he just expects a certain outflow that he compensated with the inflow. So you'd have Twitter, Facebook, YouTube as ways to initiate new people to his system. And so cutting off the the ease with which he can get new people in has hurt him because that outflow still exists. That's kind of the way I look at what these bands have done. There's sort of a disruption to the initiation phase, while the people leaving phase has continued the same way.
Ah, okay. So you also pointed out you think his audience has gotten really up there in age.
Well, I base a lot of that on just the demographic information you could find on, like, Alexa and Quantcast. Mm-hmm. Like, if you go and look at those places, it's, you know, and it's the same thing with Fox News, too. Like, those places, largely, their demographics are male, white, and over 40. Yeah, so, and once you get past, like, 50, 60, it's a lot of the demographic is that age, too. So, I think Fox News actually, the last time I checked, which admittedly was a good 6 months ago or so, Fox News was worse. Like, their sort of average age was higher. But Alex is still very healthy in that not young cohort. But that's what Alex is trying to fix. With, like, recently he was out in L.A. and he went on Logan Paul's show, these sorts of things. He's trying to make inroads to younger people because that's a market that he hasn't tapped and I don't think he has much appeal to. And so, you know, if you have an audience that's largely retirees or that, you know, that side of the age spectrum, it can't be sustainable unless you bring in and find a way to appeal to a younger set.
So by normal media tax, we would then assume that Jones is going to be less relevant across the board. But one of the things that I have noticed, you know, because dealing with right-wingers, is certain Jonesisms that I never heard Republicans use in polite conversation before. Like globalist, have become commonplace.
Yeah. Even in the president saying these sorts of dog-whistly terms. And, yeah, people all over government. Yeah, it is troubling.
I guess the question is, do we look at Alex Jones right now and see, you know, a failure? And in some ways, like, I think there's a lot of signs of it. Paul Joseph Watson bailing ship. His numbers are clearly declining. He seems to be changing what supplement forms he's hawking at any given time.
Yeah, it seems to shifting. I don't know. I mean, he announced that partnership with the multi-level marketing scheme, Jeunesse, but he also seems to have not. I don't know. It's strange. You do see these signs of flagging, but also a lot of that, like, our perception is based on a bit of a short term here with this. He's in crisis now for sure, but it's hard to say what the picture will look like in, let's say, 6-9 months. Like, everything could, there's the possibility of things changing dramatically.
One thing you've been pointing out when you're discussing modern episodes, which I know you don't enjoy as much because it feels a little bit too real.
Well, there's that. And then also I don't have the gift of foresight or a hindsight. You know, like when we look at, like, 2009, 2013, it's much easier to look into the things he's saying and see if there's credence to them. Whereas in the present day, there's so many things that he's saying that he's relying on most likely fake secret sources about, but the stories haven't played out. There's breaking news, and it's really hard to debunk those things as they're in the present. And I find that immensely ungratifying. So that's a big part of it. And then also in the present day, he's just a monster. He's trying to get people hurt, particularly people in the LGBT community and Muslims. Like, he's really agitating in ways that he hopes people are hurt or killed. And it's very unpleasant to look at. Even if we're against him, it's still something that it takes an emotional toll.
Yeah, it's I have noticed that too. The violence of the rhetoric has increased, even though he'll throw in that he does seem to have enough sense to throw in a disclaimer that he doesn't mean it literally, or that, like, the Civil War is defensive.
Right.
But it does make his defenses that he's never encouraged anyone to hurt anybody else seem completely disingenuous.
He seems to think that he can say, "I want to shoot you politically," and that's not a threat. Like, just putting the word "politically" on a really violent rant, he seems to think that that's like, "Aha, I got you on a technicality," and it's scary. But I'm sorry, I feel like I interrupted a question there.
Oh no, I was just I am sort of trying to figure the how we should feel about him right now out. One of the things that you were pointing out, though, is he is not, like many people, even on the far right, he's not as sanguine on Trump. I like to call this kind of cynically the Obama moment. And what I mean by that is, like, 2 years in, but before the Republicans took Congress, when Obama just really couldn't do a lot of things, people thought, even things he didn't promise he was going to do, but they thought he was going to do.
Yeah.
There's a massive disillusionment with him on the left, on the far left in particular, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like we've seen something similar with the fringe right and Trump. And you hear that in Jones, but he vacillates so much.
Yeah, yeah. He says, like, Trump made me turn on Trump when he's drunk on Rogan's show. And then he gets back to Austin and gets back to work, and he's right back to justifying any kind of horrible thing that Trump said or did. So, it's become a sort of a tease for me covering it, like this idea of, like, is this the time that he's going to finally get the picture and break with this albatross around his neck? And it just never is. Like, when Trump bombed Syria, Alex got drunk on air and started screaming about how Trump shoves ISIS up our dirty assholes, started crying on air. And, everyone thought, like, oh, this is the moment. This is where Alex finally is, like, he's had enough. And that was a year ago or something. You know, it seems like it's never going to quite happen.
But it's, one of the interesting things now is Roger Stone is more or less out of the picture, as is Paul right. Joseph Watson.
Well, so, Paul's still kind of there. I think that break is going to be a bit more gradual than Paul and Alex made it seem on their show. I think I'm not sure. I think that there might be a performative aspect to that break. I'm not entirely sure. I'm starting to have those thoughts. But Roger, definitely. But Roger's gone.
At the same time, I was originally talking about Alex Jones as a has-been, and a friend of mine with your kind of right-wing sympathies pointed out to me how much money he's still making. And that is one thing I was shocked to discover, is how much money is actually in Alex Jones' world. Like, it's like they have made tons of money off these supplements and multi-level marketing schemes and media model.
Well, I mean, you wouldn't do the grift if the grift didn't work, like no one would sell snake oil if there wasn't money in it.
That's true. But it seems like there's a lot more money in the current grift than there was in, say, gold in 2008.
Yeah, definitely. But that also might have been because he was relying on Ted Anderson, the guy who owns Midas Resources, to be his, like, middleman with a lot of that gold stuff. So in many ways, that grift, he was the front man for it, but he wasn't in control of it. Because now I think there's a lot more control he's wielding over his grift.
So one of the fascinating things I learned from your episode recently, which played the deposition, and you were kind of upset with the discourse around the deposition. Mm-hmm. Would you like to go into that a little bit, and then I'll bring up where I brought it up?
Oh, sure. I mean, well, in terms of what you're bringing up, I believe, is the idea that a lot of media places were reporting that Alex admitted he has a psychosis that makes him a conspiracy theorist. And for a really long time, one of the things that I've taken note of is how poorly the media covers people like Alex, like all these sorts of folk. These manipulative dicks, they do a bad job. And this reporting on what happened to the deposition in that light and with that lead, it really works in Alex's interests. Because if you report that he said that he has a psychosis that makes him a conspiracy theorist, if you listen to the deposition, that's not appropriate. That's not the context of what he was saying. That's not, though he uses the word psychosis, so you're literally, technically not lying, you're spiritually manipulating the context and the surrounding conversation that Alex was having. And when you do that, Alex can then say, the media lies about me, and this is just more proof that I'm the truth teller, they're the fake news, and all this sort of thing. You end up providing him an opportunity to do what he does best, which is play the victim and obfuscate reality. So when people report on him that way, I've seen it 100 times in the last 2 years or so of doing this show. People just don't cover him correctly. And it's one step forward, 2 steps back, because ostensibly you're covering him and offering a critique, but at the same time, you're moving things backward.
Yeah, and kind of playing into to his own narrative. And what I found fascinating from listening to your show on that deposition is, one, no one's talking about how damning that deposition kind of was on certain aspects of it. Like, he basically admits that he doesn't proof anything.
Oh, and he doesn't know what InfoWars LLC is.
Yeah, that's what I bring up. And the other thing is, he doesn't really seem to know how his business works. Like, his own, like, because there's multiple corporations involved in this InfoWars stuff, which...
Oh, yeah.
You pointed out to me. I didn't realize how many different LLCs there were.
There are a bunch, yeah. He has a weird... His corporate structure is very strange.
And he doesn't seem to know, or is unwilling to actually say, under oath, what his... one of the branches is doing.
Yeah, it's strange. I'm not sure if that's him actually not knowing or if it is protecting the business. Like, I really have no idea what his motivation is. But yeah, it's real strange because he's the only person listed as like the primary person in these LLCs and in his business structure. So it's without being like a corporate lawyer, it's really hard for me to assume what his motivation is, but nothing seems like it's on the up and up. Mm-hmm. Like whether it's just he's the guy who runs all this stuff and doesn't know what they do, or he's afraid to admit what they do when he's in a like deposition, neither of those seem like positives.
The other thing that's interesting about Alex right now is arguably, you know, we've talked about it, he's closer to mainstream discourse than he's ever been. Other than the fact that his show seems so much more hateful, they also seem, I don't know, it seems like he has a harder time getting guests.
I think a lot of his old guests don't want to come on anymore because it's not good for their brand. Like, a lot of people probably used Alex as a platform for them to get their grift going. And now that Alex isn't on YouTube, isn't on Twitter or Facebook, it's not good for them anymore. So the people that he ends up getting are these fucked up people who are philosophically aligned with him. People like a Faith Goldie or a Vox Day. These sorts of folks are the people who will still pop around. But people, you know, there's a long list of his old guests who are still alive, but I don't know where they are. People like, I haven't seen Gerald Celente come on in recent memory. He used to be on all the time. You brought up Webster Tarpley. He obviously won't be back on because he rightly predicted Trump's aspirational authoritarian tendencies. He can get guests, but the guests that he get are not the same folks anymore.
What also seems hard for me for people to deny his ties to the far right when he's having Faith Goldie on.
Yeah, that's tough. You know, or like Vox Day, who, admires Anders Breivik. You know, like there's the sort of people that he has access to now are much harder core, I think, than the soft peddlers of bigotry and stuff like a Paul Craig Roberts or something like that in days past.
And also that fits the model too. And Paul Craig Roberts was always more comfortable like working with leftists, right? He wrote for Counterpunch and
right. But he also wrote for V-Dare. So.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. I don't want to absolve him, but like
sure.
But that he seems to also be a creature of back in the days where those weird left-right alliances were more of a thing.
Yeah. I think maybe the breaking point with some of that might have been Occupy. I'm not entirely sure, but it feels like the timeline also fits that.
Well, that's fascinating about Occupy. As a person who comes out of the far left and has some history on the paleoconservative right way back, mm-hmm. Occupy, I do remember, and now I was abroad for most of it, but I actually came back to the States that winter during Occupy to see what was going on while I was doing an assignment for the school I was working for. And I went to Occupy Atlanta, Occupy New York, and Occupy Oakland. And what I noticed in Occupy Atlanta was there were a lot of Alex Jonesy types sure. there. Mm-hmm. And I've also heard that was true in Texas too, at the Occupy Austin and stuff like that. But it also seems like any delusions of possible allegiance between the anti-globalization movement and anti-globalist other than the fact that there is a root word that is similar, seem to have ended at that time.
Yeah, I want to cover Alex's response to those protests and the Occupy movement in general much more. We did one episode about when the people were kicked out of Zuccotti Park, I believe. I believe that was the day that we covered. And I think that the sense that I got was you had these people who were doing their sit-in, their occupation, and then you had people like Alex and his world. And they tried to make these protests about what they wanted to make it about. And I think that that tension might have been part of what made it more difficult for those right and left to get together, because you had these people on the right who were drawn towards this thing that was happening, but they also were drawn to it in a way that they were trying to co-opt it. I suspect that there might have been like a moment where that became clear and perhaps a distrust grew out of that.
Well, I've thought about this a lot. Marxists have a hard time talking to like libertarians who seem to share their opinions on like banking cycles and stuff. But when they actually sit down, they're like, why they think it's a problem, and the worldview is not copacetic. Like, and I think that probably was when that a lot of that became clear. It's interesting to me how. You know, you do see some, I mean, there's still some overlap in this. You'll hear people like, you'll still have leftists who kind of agree with right-wingers and things like Syria.
Sure.
But in general, that doesn't, it just seems like the ideologies have clarified their positions in such a way that their incompatibility is like universally obvious.
Yeah, I think that there's the possibility for sort of superficial agreement. And I think that does happen a lot, but there's so much more going on underneath those superficial agreements that make it almost impossible to side with certain elements.
It does seem interesting, though, and one of the things that you pointed out, another difficulty of listening to modern Alex Jones shows, is like trying to figure out if he actually believes in anything. Like we talked about how he doesn't out himself when he's drunk. At the same time, how do you reconcile calling for national emergency on the scale that Jones wanted him to call for it with Alexis Jones' years of talking about posse comitatus and the imperial presidency and all that?
Well, the way that I reconcile it is that he's never really been that against authoritarianism or a repressive government. He's just afraid of it being applied to him. And in the sense that Trump becoming this authoritarian leader, I think that he recognizes that straight white males are not going to be a primary target. And I think that he feels safe. I can't say that based on him overtly saying these things, but it's the sense I get from his rhetoric. And like you're pointing out, how much these things have changed. And when have they changed? Well, they've changed now. That's suspicious to me.
Yeah, I mean, What was the other thing that you pointed out? His weird love of Bolsonaro.
Yeah, that is weird.
You know, he also doesn't speak ill of Duterte.
No, nope. He's pretty in favor because Trump has made friends with him or whatever. I think some of that might just be based on Alex having, I don't know if he can read well anymore. And he seems to have no interest in reality outside of his narratives. So it's the same thing with like Venezuela right now. He's on the same tip with that. He's like anti-foreign intervention, yet at the same time is super in favor of foreign intervention. It only can be under like these hypocrisies seem like glaring holes in his thinking or whatever. And tell you the only way that I can make sense of them is to look at these principles that he espouses, even though he built his entire career on scaring people about FEMA camps and posse comitatus and stuff like that. That if you recontextualize it and look at those beliefs as being conditional, it makes a lot more sense.
If we're looking at what we think were principles are actually just tactical, then the question comes, what are his real principles?
Or tactical is one way, but also conditional principles. Mm-hmm. Like, because I do still think that he had them as, like, they still guided him in some way. Like, I don't think that they were just strategic talking points that he was using. I do think that he felt those things to some extent. I don't know if you, it'd be hard for me to say exactly, but I think that just upholding of the status quo is primarily what a lot of his ideology circles to. It feels that way now, at least.
It's fascinating to me because he did seem so, like such a countercultural figure even before the Obama years. I mean, particularly in the Bush years, it was, you know, the way they talk about George W. Bush. But that wasn't just him. If you look at like the Patriot movement as a whole, and by the Patriot movement, we really mean the militia movement.
Right.
They all seem to have gone that way, kind of.
Well, sure. I mean, like, but what was that all based on? It was based on a fear of, you know, the more pluralistic state of affairs for people to have rights, and the reactionary element of the militia patriot movement was largely centered around this idea of a more equitable distribution of people having the right to exist. You know, the idea of the power base being taken away from heterosexual white male Christians.
Well, it's been interesting to me to move. I'll bring back to the Patriot movement in a second because it's fascinating. But the libertarian movement's response to all this stuff, in so much that there are like, how many libertarians do you meet these days? I don't feel like there are many left.
I think they call themselves like classical liberals now or something like that. You know,
right,
I think
but they're not the same kind of people, though, really. I mean, they are, but they're not. Like,
well, I mean, you got Gary Johnson running in the last election, I guess. No libertarian I've ever talked to was super excited about that. Yeah. I don't know. I think the brand might have just fizzled.
Well, one of the things that I joked about with left wingers is like when I first got into podcasting in like 2011, and you looked up political podcasts, every single one of them was libertarian. Like, except for like Democracy Now. It was like Democracy Now, the NPR liberal things that they were already radio shows, and then 1,000 libertarian podcasts.
So basically we're living in a house that libertarians built.
Yeah, kind of. And
they're on the vanguard,
but they also sort of fell away really quickly. And like even increasingly during like the Obama years, it seems like actually it wasn't even like Trump; it was the Tea Party that seemed to have taken a wind out of all those sails.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think going back to Webster Tarpley, that the essay that he put out in the lead up to the 2016 election was a damning screed about the idea that libertarianism has no moral center, and there's no sort of, I don't know if you'd put it this way, but I'd say like sincerity to it, and that libertarian ideology is kind of a gateway ideology that leads to something else. And his argument is that it is the foyer into the house of authoritarianism.
Yeah, well, I mean, I started sort of pointing this out when I started seeing Pinochet memes. I mean, like, you know, you're a libertarian, but you're for throwing people out of helicopters by the government all of a sudden. Like,
no, it's just a joke, man. Yeah. Just a joke.
Sure.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that there's a possibility that there's something to that, though, that it's just like a lot of people who were in those camps transitioned out into other things. And I think generally the pipeline goes more extreme as opposed to returning towards a more, I don't know, milquetoast version of politics.
Well, I mean, I do know a lot of libertarians that became liberals over time, but they're much quieter about it.
They're ashamed.
Yeah, just like, we don't mention our past, please shut up. But no, if you talk about key figures, yeah, it almost, with the exception of some true believers who work at Reason Magazine, it seems like almost nobody's left.
Yeah, that landscape is barren.
When you have Stephen Molyneux and stuff doing what they're doing right now, it's like, yeah, you guys didn't believe it, did you?
He's a great example of that. That sort of doorway, libertarianism as a doorway. I got the sense that Stefan Molyneux is always just using libertarianism, though. Like he's an example of someone who I think is a creep and manipulative as Alex is. I think Stefan is on a completely different sort of grift. And from videos that I've watched of him from like way back, Like, it seems like he's using libertarianism and the non-aggression principle specifically for his own purposes.
Well, I mean, the fact that he has cult tactics, I mean, even when I was still kind of on the right in 2005, like, people would point out, man, this Molyneux guy, and he was around even back then. I mean, Free Domain Radio has been around for a long time.
Yeah. I unfortunately recently looked into some of that stuff, and
he was encouraging you to, like, break with all your friends and family if they ever violated the non-aggression principle even a little bit.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, this is scary.
As much as Alex scares me, I someone like a Molyneux scares me so much more. And to see them take very similar trajectories scares me tremendously.
Well, yeah, that's what's worrying is, I'm not going to say the Trump years have been great for the far right. In some ways, like, it's actually been sunlight, and it's been a little bit of disinfectant because people are now paying attention. Because coming out of the weirdo circles I come out of, like, I've known about some of these people for a decade or more, and no one cared until recently. But it's interesting to see this come out now. I mean, like, and you now have people putting scrutiny on things that they wouldn't put scrutiny on. Your show's a good example of that. You are very good at actually looking up the various people who comes on Jones' show and figuring out what their real deal is. And sometimes, A, it doesn't seem that Jones even knows. And true. B, like, it's creepier even in the old days than people were letting on.
Yeah, yeah. And I take that as a criticism that you're not criticizing, but I take it as criticism that I apply to myself, that, like, I'm guilty of that too. Like, I didn't think that this was a topic worth covering a couple of years ago, even before we started. And I always kick myself a little bit in the sense that, like, man, what more robust understanding of what's going on could we have had if we started 5 years before we did?
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's episode. Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives are produced for Zero Books by the team of C. Derek Varn, J.G. Michael, Amog Sahu, and Toby Kamir, our ever-faithful producer and editor. Please keep following us on the Inside Zero Books Patreon account for additional episodes. Have a good day.